You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 254, introducing the book of Exodus. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Ready to jump into a new book. Man, can you believe it? I'm still kind of shocked that Exodus won the vote.
I know, and as we talked about last show, it was neck and neck, and I had to extend it again for an extra day just to try to get some separation, and by 1%, Exodus won. I can't believe it. I'm excited.
I'm gonna like it. But I was already like assuming that it would be the end times thing, and so I'd actually already started like prepping stuff, you know, weeks and weeks ago, and so I had to shift gears. That's why I said I'm still kind of shocked. Well, that I'm working on this and not the other.
A lot of people have commented that they kind of want you to mesh the end times into Exodus all together, and so make one big mashup.
Yeah, well, that's like Mission Impossible.
Well, this is like,
we just have to make stuff up.
Then. Yeah, and Exodus, I mean, this is like your wheelhouse, right? I mean, the Torah is like where Mike lived.
Yeah, there's lots of Egyptology stuff in here. So this is, there's fun stuff, but I'll admit, and I'll mention it as we get into it here, that there's a lot of indeterminate, uncertain, in some cases, mind-bending or mind-numbing stuff here too. So I can't promise that you're going to get every question nailed down with absolute certainty. I can promise that we're going to go over things in detail, and you'll sort of know why things are debated. And when the dust settles, you'll have a lot to think about. You can land where it is you like.
Oh yeah, and with 40 chapters, I mean, it's like we're wandering around for 40 years. I mean, it's going to be
seeing a metaphor there.
I can only imagine how detailed. I mean, every episode is going to be 2 hours, 40 weeks long. Plus, you probably have part A, B, C for one chapter, like sometimes we do.
There'll be a few things I already know that it's going to require set up even before you get into the subject, but that'll happen.
Yeah, and our audience, including myself, we love that stuff. So it's time to.
Well, it's a good thing you have a high tolerance for
that. I'm excited. I know everybody else got it. Everybody in the groups and on Facebook and emails and stuff. We had a little meme contest, kind of, and that's kind of why on Facebook you'll see everybody doing memes and stuff. It's absolutely fun. I'm so glad everybody has humor, even in the losing people.
A sense of humor,
And so I appreciate our listeners because life is so serious. There's no reason to be so emotional and defensive. And so I'm glad our audience is like us, Mike. They're just relaxed and they take it in stride, and it's okay. And it's, it's good to laugh and have fun with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm
plenty of things to keep your mind engaged. So let's just jump in here. Like we always do with book studies, we're going to introduce the book. And what that means is, I'm not going to like give you this long outline. I'm not going to talk all about, date and occasion and all. I mean, I'll say a few things here and there. But what I tend to want to do in these introductory episodes is sort of give you a foretaste of the kinds of things we're going to have to think about, the walls we're going to hit, the problems and the controversies that are going to pop up that we're going to have to, try to think carefully through, sort of just give a foretaste of where we're headed. I will say something, because Exodus is part of the Torah, part of the Pentateuch, the quote unquote law of Moses. As I've mentioned many times before, when it comes to the authorship of the Torah, the Pentateuch, I am what used to be called a supplementarian. I don't buy the JEDP theory as it's presented. I also don't buy the Moses wrote every word of the Pentateuch or even 90% of it. A supplementarian is one who accepts Mosaic authorship, for parts of the Torah, the core, ideas, the core episodes, perhaps, that kind of thing. That there's a definite Mosaic contribution here. There's no reason to think that the Moses could not have written substantially the material that we find in the Torah. Now, there are lots of reasons why people doubt that, especially critical scholars. And some of their reasons make more sense than others. A lot of the JEDP idea is based on circular reasoning. So it assumes what it needs to prove and then thinks it's proven it. So I sort of reject both poles. And I think what we have here in the Torah is a mosaic core. There was stuff that Moses wrote. And then it got accrued to. There were parts added to it later on by other hands. And there were editorial things done to the content as time went on. You know, God used a number of people whose names we'll never know to put these five books into their final form. So again, that used to be sort of a mainstream view in scholarship at one point, centuries ago, maybe a century or century and a half ago. It's not so much now anymore, but I'm still there because I think that just is the best way to account for all the data. So I accept, mosaic authorship. I accept other authorship. I accept editing by other hands, repurposing sources, the use of sources, all that stuff. Now, what that means is that the question of date of the book is going to be variable and ultimately indeterminate because they're just going to, you don't know which hand, did what. We'll hit places, and I'll allude to a couple here in this episode where it's very clear that there's an editorial hand at work. Well, we have no idea when that happened. So you can't pin a date on the book of Exodus generally, that the Torah generally. You might be able to argue well, this part's before, or in this part of Israel's history, this part's in another part of Israel's history. You can do a little bit of that. But as far as, like pinholing a date, that's just not really possible. I have a quotation here from Eugene Carpenter's commentary. He did, the Lexham Press did the, it's still an ongoing series, the Evangelical Exegetical Commentary. And Eugene Carpenter did Exodus for us. And he writes this. He says, "The composition of Exodus is complex and challenging and is inextricably tied up with the broader issue of the composition of the Pentateuch. The way the author-editor has compiled the great variety of material in Exodus is an example of literary and theological genius." We're going to return to that theological part in a bit. Carpenter says that Moses was in essence the author of the book as indicated by the text itself. Certainly Moses' life and activities account for the origin of the book. That others had a hand in its composition even during the Mosaic era is both asserted and implied. For example, Joshua, Miriam, Ithamar, Eleazar, and the Levitical priests. These people contributed to the formation of the Torah. They were not the author-editor in the sense that Moses was. They were, however, inspired and followed in Moses' inspired leadership and composition of the biblical text. Several sources are suggested in the text as well, though not so evident. Certain post-Mosaic statements or features of the book indicate a post-Mosaic date for the final form of the book. So that's a good summary of a supplementarian perspective on this. And again, that's the camp I'm in. Now, Carpenter goes on to list a few sort of instances or texts that suggest, again, multiple hands. And he writes this. "The text itself ascribes the following writing activities to Moses. At God's command, he wrote the continuing warfare that Yahweh would direct against Amalek," it's Exodus 17, 14, and 15, "and recited it to Joshua. He wrote down the words of the Book of the Covenant after presenting them orally to the people," Exodus 24, verses 3 and 4. "And he was instructed to record the material in Exodus 34, 10 through 27. The text also tells us that Moses charged Aaron's son Ithamar to keep a careful record of the materials used to construct the tabernacle," Exodus 38, 21. "Joshua was Moses' aide," Exodus 24, 13, a term that indicates that he may have served as Moses' major recorder. Joshua stands out as the man who knew Moses par excellence, and it is said of him that he made a covenant, Joshua 24, 25, for the people at Shechem. He set up for them ordinances or decrees, laws or fixed rules, and model cases, Joshua 24, 26. only an inspired and approved successor, such as Joshua was at the time, could have, without impunity, written these things into, quote, the book of the law of God, unquote. This literary activity, coupled with his also writing the law of God upon tablets of stone, Joshua 8:32, suggests that he may have helped shape parts of the Pentateuchal materials. That's the end of the Carpenter quote. Now, Carpenter has a footnote at the end of that which says this: the tradition of the Jewish fathers as passed down through Pirkei Avot 1:1 is, quote, Moses received the Torah on Sinai and handed it down to Joshua. Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets handed it down to the men of the great assembly. Carpenter adds, there may be more historical truth in this assertion than has been allowed in the past. In other words, this notion of succession, of approved successors, I think is legitimately the context for the editorial activity, not only in the Pentateuch, but really throughout the Hebrew Bible. It's not, you know, they weren't out there like Dairy Queen, you know, hiring interns or something. Hey, we need a little work on this manuscript over here. You're just out of high school, so come on over. No, I mean, these were community, not only expert scribes who would do this activity, but they were recognized by the community as legitimate successors to the tradition. And again, in the context, I've talked on many occasions in the podcast about how I think it's far more coherent biblically to view inspiration as a process, not an event, or even a series of events, as a process that God is aware of. He's watching, he's superintending the entire way through, and it could take centuries. God had a sustained interest in producing this thing that we now call the Bible. It wasn't just a moment-by-moment, zapping-by-zapping interest. If you take that view, and again, I've been quite open with that is my view of inspiration, and I've had a number of lectures that show why that's a whole lot better than, you know, the way inspiration is traditionally taught. You look at it, you know, from that framework, it makes sense, again, that the community would recognize certain individuals, and they were skilled, and they were just thought to be part of God's hand in producing the final form of whatever, you know, whatever they were working on, in this case, the Pentateuch and the book of Exodus. So again, that's how I approach authorship, and it has implications, you know, for dating. And we'll hit some of those things as we go through the book. By way of an outline, I actually think it's convenient for listeners to keep this really, really, really basic outline in mind. Again, this is also, you know, partly based on Carpenter. The book breaks down into three sections really easily. There's chapter 1, verse 1, up through chapter 15, verse 21. That is from the oppression of Israel to their deliverance. Okay? In other words, those are events in Egypt. Okay, or concerning Egypt. Real easy. You get past 15:21, so chapter 15, verse 22 through 18:27. Those are events at Sinai, or events leading on the way to Sinai. So we have the Exodus from Egypt occur, and then the journey to Sinai. So the first section is events in Egypt. Second section is events on the way to Sinai, and that means the last section is stuff that happened at Sinai. That's Exodus 19, verse 1, all the way to the end of the book, chapter 40 through 38. That's stuff that happens while they're at Sinai. So it's a real easy outline. Going to Egypt, going to Sinai, and then they're at Sinai. Book divides real nicely into three sections. But I think more interesting is the kinds of issues we'll run into throughout the book. And I'm going to sort of chop this up into two sets of issues. And the second set, I'm going to spend a lot of time on, really the lion's share of this episode of the podcast on. I think it's a good play. We need to cover some things in there right from the get-go. The other stuff, the first set, you know, we'll bump into these things along the way. So I'm only going to say a little bit about them. So the first set of issues are related to problems of chronology and archaeology. And within that set, I'm really kind of thinking of two things, two kinds of problems. One is the problem of archaeological absence. And that is, does it matter that there is no certain archaeological evidence for the man Moses, for Joshua? I mean, we haven't, you know, uncovered like the grave of Moses and it's really him, or you know, some Egyptian literary corpus that retells the story of the Israelites in Egypt, and leaving Egypt, and actually uses names like Moses and Joshua and Aaron. Okay, does it matter? There's an issue of absence there. Does that matter? Okay. Secondly, there are problems of archaeological data that do exist and its interpretation. So the first kind of problem is archaeological absence. Second is archaeological data and how that is viewed, how that's interpreted. Now, it's going to take more, more than one episode and more than one little segment like this to really get into the nuts and bolts of chronological debate, the problems of how things that have been discovered archaeologically affect the way scholars date not only the book, but date the events, the people, the persons, and so on and so forth. We're going to run into these things throughout the book in different places. So I just want to reference it here. And I'm actually kind of bringing it up, again, this set of problems about interpretation of data, archaeology and chronology. I'm actually bringing it up because of the film Patterns of Evidence. I've been asked, I think, in Q&A maybe once or twice about this. I'll put it, I'm positively predisposed or disposed, to the film. And I'll try to explain very briefly why here. But I want to say, though, having said that, if you think that film solves all or even most of the problems related to the Exodus, you're wrong. Okay. What it does, it doesn't really solve anything. What it does is it presents a particular approach to the problems and then offers a solution. Okay, offers, it proposes something. Hey, let's if we consider it this way, then things kind of look differently. They kind of work out. And it's drawing on the work of David Rohl. That's Rohl. We'll get into all this stuff, the date of the Exodus problem, which of course is tied to chronological method. It's also tied to external chronological issues and interpretation of archaeological data. What I mean by that is, if you think the date of the Exodus concerns only 1 Kings 6:1, which basically says in the fourth year of Solomon, that was the 480th anniversary from the time of the Israelites leaving Egypt. Well, there the verse gives us the date. It's 1446 BC because Solomon, the fourth year, 976, you just do the math or 966, you do the math and you come out 1446 BC. Well, that's wonderful. How did we get a real-time BC date for that? The Bible doesn't give you ever BC or AD dates. What it gives you is lifespans of individuals. It gives you relative chronology. Well, this king reigns X number of years, and he was replaced by this guy, and that guy reigned X number of years. Then he was replaced by another guy. This is what you get. You get strings of years. You get reign lengths, lifetime spans. Nothing fixes it into real-time history. For that, you need to come up with a way to correlate something written in a text with astronomy. Because astronomy is how we record and understand and fix time. Our calendars operate on astronomical principles, astronomical observation. I mean, who in the world invented this system? That's a good question. How did anybody know really how to apply it to the Bible? That's another good question. What about ancient civilizations outside the Bible? Egypt, Mesopotamia, Assyria, Babylon. They were doing astronomy too. How does their system hook into astronomy, and do all the systems agree? Good questions. And what Patterns of Evidence actually does, I mean, it doesn't get into the nuts and bolts, but David Rohl was part of what used to be called the Ancient Chronology Forum on the internet. I used to be a chronology nerd. I'm still a nerd, but in other ways. I used to be really into this. And it is so complicated. It is so variable. And frankly, it is so uncertain that I have frequently referred to ancient chronology and problems and debates about chronology as nothing more than a quagmire. That's what it is. So what Patterns of Evidence does is it presents Rowles, David Rowles, ideas of how to align certain texts in Egypt with biblical texts that are now separated by about 200 years because of the way these texts are dated and because of the way the dynastic chronology of Egypt is dated. And Rowles is saying, well, there are problems with the whole system that allow him to scrunch, to compress the chronology 200 years. If you've seen the film, you know, you've seen these really, and they are cool. You know, I know, you know, Tim Mahoney, you know, who made the film. He's a really good guy. You know, just, again, I liked the film because it does a good job of presenting Rowles' presentation of the problems and his proposed solution. And it has wonderful graphics. And if you've seen it, you know, they'll talk about how, you know, the mainstream has this text over here in Egypt and the Bible says this, but they're separated by 200 years because of the way things are dated. And if we could just compress the chronology, smash them together so that these texts would align in their dating, like, voila, you know, it looks like this Egyptian thing is describing what's going on over in the Old Testament. Yeah, it does. It does. But the film doesn't raise this question. On what basis, by what authority, can we just compress 200 years? We can see that it works nicely. It produces a nice result. But on what basis do we do that? Let's say that, yeah, there are problems in chronology. Well, why are we worried more about correlating things in Exodus than actually fixing a real-time chronology? Because the film only deals with the Bible in Egypt. What about the Assyrians? What about the Babylonians? What about the Hittites? What about the Greeks? I mean, they all have their own chronological systems as well. It's the Mediterranean. They're looking at the same sun and the same moon. They're all doing astronomy and calendar. You know, what if we only compressed it 50 years and everything lined up? Well, that still leaves us with a gap with the Bible. In other words, this is what happens in ancient chronology discussion. People aren't just trying to relate the external ancient Near East with the Bible. And some of them aren't even interested in that at all. Some of them are trying to correlate the entire Mediterranean, every system, with each other to produce a coherent chronological reconstruction that has no outliers. And there's a lot that can go wrong. There's a lot that cannot be known because there are disagreements all over the place, even in astronomical observation and the way those observations are described. There's a lot of ambiguity in a particular, you know, the Egyptian system deals with something called the Sothic cycle, the rise of Sirius, Sothis. Well, depending on how it's worded, that may refer to an event that happens every year, or it may refer to a cycle of 1,460 years. And guess what? The writers never tell us. People have to guess. Ancient chronology is based on a lot of guessing. Some of it is more educated than others. You know, there is no synchronicity. There's no wholesale synchronicity across the ancient Mediterranean. And whole books and whole studies have been written about this problem, these problems. So again, these don't get solved by a film called Patterns of Evidence. Again, it presents Rowles' view and it does it really nicely visually. But it doesn't inform you as to what gives Rowles the authority to compress the whole thing by 200 years. It looks nice at the end of the compression. Looks really nice. But you have to ask yourself that question, again, by what authority? How do we know that this is the right thing to do, you know, honoring all of the evidence, not just textually, but astronomically, archaeologically, all of it? And then the second question is, well, does our compression work everywhere else? Aha. Again, this is a quagmire. But we're going to get into, because we have to, you know, issues of ancient chronology. The best I can do, again, I'm not going to solve all the problems either. The best I can do is explain to you why scholars argue one direction or the other, how it works, what's the basis of their conclusions. And then, you know, you can do further research and land where you will. But again, that's the that's the stuff that we'll run into periodically. What I want to spend most of the time, the rest of the time of our episode on here, is the second set of problems. And that is those are problems of historiography and literary presentation. You know, how the Book of Exodus presents its content. And what I mean by here is really, you can put it in a simple question. Is Exodus theology or history? Or is the answer yes? Or a little bit of both? You know, how do we view this? Does the existence of a meta narrative, the laying out of God's salvation plan, does that nullify history or does it require it? Does it reinforce it? Are those two things compatible? What I mean by this is, it's very evident to scholars, I mean, if you pick up a good commentary on Exodus, that things written in Exodus are hooking back into Genesis, like with the patriarchs. And you will get fulfillments of certain things said to the patriarchs, or you'll get sort of a progression of like the covenant, covenantal language, language about the land and all this sort of thing. So that makes it very clear that the writer of Exodus is presenting theology. It's presenting God's activity with his people in this particular place to propel what he is going to do to reinstall the kingdom on earth and to, again, gather his people back to himself, who are estranged, you know, from him and the nations and so on and so forth. So in presenting those theological points, a lot of people wonder, well, is that the same as history, or is he just doing theology? Like are these two different things? Are they two related things? Are they compatible or incompatible? Those are the big questions. So that again prompts other things like, well, how should we think about biblical historiography, the writing of biblical narrative? How should we think about a term like historicity? I mean, what is history? What is historicity? You know, how do we view these things? How much precision is required for something to be considered historical, especially by modern thinkers? If we can look at a passage in Exodus and we can see that the passage is actually arranged deliberately, or it does something deliberately to convey a theological point, does that mean that the writer had to sort of ignore history to do that? Or is he using history? Or is there some other kind of relationship? What if we have polemic mythicizing going on? You know, the writer's taken a shot at some ancient Near Eastern religious idea or a deity. Well, in the process of doing that, do we have history then? Or is the guy just given somebody a theological poke in the eye by the way he tells a story? Is the story being told real history, or is it, you know, a theological punch in the nose? Or are those two things inherently distinct and separable, or do they work together? I mean, these are the big picture questions that we have to think about. And let me give you some examples here. And there's a lot of them. Again, we're going to run into all these things in the book. And so I'm just going to run through them. Why does Exodus, again, purportedly written by Moses in the 15th or maybe the 12th, depending on what chronology you use, you know, 12th century BC. Why does Moses use a word, karuv, cherub, that has a well-known Mesopotamian origin? Why does he do that? The only other place we see the karuv is in Genesis, you know, 3. And Genesis 1-11, as I've said before, has lots and lots and lots of Babylonian connections to them. I thought the context for the Exodus was Egypt. Why is this word there? I mean, the Egyptians didn't use this. Why do elements of the tabernacle mimic Egyptian, Mesopotamian, and Canaanite artifacts? The Ark of the Covenant has a clear point of analogy to Egyptian palanquins. We'll talk about their boxes, you know, with figures of the deity inside them, okay? The menorah has a very clear Mesopotamian counterpart, the whole tree of life kind of thing that has Mesopotamian roots. Again, there we get Genesis 1-11 content. The structure of the tabernacle, the outline of it, though, is very Canaanite. Why do we get all three of these? Why isn't it consistent? In each section, again, the writers, you know, or editors of Exodus will repurpose material found in Genesis to remind readers of things that happened before in God's redemptive plan. does that make the storytelling artificial? Or is it true history? Is it mythic? And what does mythic even mean? Is that history? You know, does it negate historicity? A myth, you know, in academic parlance, is a story where divine beings, supernatural beings are characters and supernatural things happen. Again, does that mean it's non-historical? Well, you know, you say no, of course. You know, God can act in history. I agree, he can. But the bigger question is, does this telling of the story have theology as its aim, or does it have history as its aim? And are those things necessarily separable? That's the bigger question. Here's another one. What about apparent literary polemic that connects whatever is being talked about in Exodus to other ancient Near Eastern stories? How about the abandoned child motif? Moses, you know, the story of Moses' birth, put in the little basket, set afloat on the Nile. Okay. There are whole studies on what scholars call the abandoned child motif. There are a lot of these in the ancient world where the hero of a story is released or abandoned, you know, by his parents, gets discovered by, you know, somebody else, and then they grow up in completely different circumstances and they become a hero of the story. They go from rags to riches, that kind of thing. But you have this abandonment as a child motif. What about Exodus 24 using language from Baal's, you know, courtyard to describe the presence of Yahweh? So you get literary polemic that's very obvious. Is that something in and of itself? Why would the story be told that way? Is this like if we went back in time, would we actually witness this as a real-time event? Or is the writer trying to make, his only goal is to make a theological point? Again, how do we view this stuff? Carpenter asks a few more. Why is Canaan the promised land? I mean, why Canaan? Why is Pharaoh never named? We're going to get into this as well, because at a certain point in Egyptian history, pharaohs do get named. But at a certain point before, they don't. Does that affect the dating of the book? Well, it might. Why is Sinai called the Mountain of God? Why is its geographical location never pinpointed? I mean, it's quite controversial as to, you know, where Mount Sinai is. Why do terms like tabernacle and tent of meeting at times overlap, and at other times they're quite distinguished? What's going on there? Why is material at times not presented in a chronologically accurate way? Here's a good example. If you go to Exodus 16:34, you have this said, "As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it," that is his rod that budded, "before the testimony to be kept." Now, the word testimony there, edut, is used of the Ark of the Covenant in other passages in Exodus. Guess what? Exodus 16, the Ark of the Covenant, hasn't even been built. What do we do with that? It's very clear that the term is used earlier than when the thing's actually built for a particular reason. And again, you know, scholars have, you know, tried to figure out what's going on here, why this. It's certainly out of order, but that's the actual question. Why does the writer or editor arrange things out of order? Is there something deliberate that they want to teach? And if the Ark of the Covenant didn't exist, should we look at this and say, well, this obviously can't be historical because the Ark wasn't even built yet? Okay, in that sense, it would be non-historical, but the writer would know that because the writer is also going to work on the passages, or the editor is going to work on the passages where the Ark is built. So he must have moved the material, you know, from this point to the next point. He must have referenced it before it was built for a reason. What would the reason be? So there you have an example of something that would be sort of in real time, potentially, I'm not going to play my hand yet here, but potentially non-historical, but still kind of historical, because it's just literature. It's just the writer or editor is just taking something from the book and repurposing it in a very deliberate way to make a particular point. Is that okay? Like, does that violate some cosmic rule of how to write a book, a religious book? Again, these are the questions that we have to ask ourselves that we're going to run into. Here's a bigger example, the life of Moses. This comes, you know, I owe this observation to John Currid's commentary. Currid, C-U-R-R-I-D. Currid has a PhD in, I don't know if it's in Egyptology, but it might be Bible and ancient Near East too, but he has really substantial training in Egyptology. He's an evangelical Old Testament prof. And in his study commentary on Exodus, published by the Evangelical Press, he notes that the early life of Moses serves as a prototype of the entire Exodus event. So he says, what I mean by that statement is that the general and major events of Moses' life while in Egypt and in Midian model and prefigure the salient circumstances in the life of the emerging nation of Israel later. And then he explains, he writes, in the foregoing analysis, the hero of Exodus was defined as Moses or Israel, you know, either one, with Yahweh as the donor or helper. He's the deliverer. What if we consider Yahweh the hero, though? Later biblical references to the liberation generally emphasize God's role, barely mentioning Moses at all. And in fact, the Exodus story is often described as a battle between Yahweh and Pharaoh over who shall possess Israel. So if you keep going, you know, through this, you wind up, again, in a different place. So we look at, you know, Moses as the hero or Yahweh as the hero. If you look at, you know, it's just going to take you in different directions. Back to his earlier comment, you know, if you actually do look at events in Moses' life, I'll just give you an example. In Exodus 2, Moses is born as a slave in Egypt under oppression and persecution. Then he, you know, in Exodus 2, a little bit later, you know, the baby Moses being put in the ark, he undergoes some water ordeal and has to be delivered. Then he escapes to Midian later in life. Then he sees a theophany of the burning bush at Mount Sinai. And then he, you know, has this doubt, you know, about, you know, God using him to deliver the nation. Well, if you look at the nation's history, in Exodus 1, they're born slaves in Egypt under bondage. Okay. Israel goes through a water ordeal at the Red Sea and is delivered. Israel escapes to Midian in Exodus 16 through 18. Israel has its own theophany experience at Sinai, and then Israel becomes unfaithful, you know, during the wilderness wanderings and so on and so forth. In other words, the circumstances of Israel as a nation mirror those of Moses. Is that artificial? You know, would we read the account, you know, one way if we look at Moses as the focal point as opposed to God as the focal point or Israel as the focal point? So again, these are big picture questions that you can see them in a close literary reading that these kind of patterns emerge. So is that artificial? Are we getting real history? Are we getting theologized history? And is theologized history not really history? Again, these are big picture questions. I could go through, again, a bunch of other examples, you know, about how when you read it as literature, there are things that emerge, patterns that emerge, that hook into not only other parts of the book and other parts of the Torah, but even wider, you know, ancient Near Eastern literature outside the Bible. And this is why scholars, again, look at Exodus. They're not asking these questions because they hate Exodus, because they hate God. They don't believe that, you know, they don't believe in inspiration. I mean, some of them do. Some of them don't have any time for an idea like inspiration and whatnot. But there are other people who are a little more thoughtful and who accept the idea of inspiration. And they wonder, well, you know, what do we have here? What do we actually have? Because we do see these patterns. The writer is very evidently doing something to us. So how do we parse that? Now, what I'm going to do for the rest of our time here is I'm going to take you through part of a presentation I did at the Frequency Conference because it was on precisely this question. I was assigned to do a presentation on the validity of the Old Testament, which was vague enough that I could more or less do what I want. So I didn't do a session on, hey, here's how we harmonize this with that and, you know, just that kind of apologetic thing. Because honestly, while that has some value, it doesn't address the bigger points. And so I think we need to think better and think well about some of these big picture questions. And so I'm going to prep you for the way I think about these things, because that will be useful the rest of the way through the book as we jump into the book. So I want to drill down on thinking well, and I would say thinking honestly about meta-narrative, about this question of is literary presentation, is that artificial, about terms like history and historicity and mythic history. Again, I'll be bold enough to say I think a lot of the critics who raise these questions, the people who sort of are hostile, I don't think they're being honest, because at the end of the day, you could take all of their questions and apply those questions to their own life story, and they would render themselves unhistorical. Now, that might sound a little odd, but I'm going to show you why that's the case. Okay. So let's start off here. The Dictionary of the Old Testament in the historical books says this. I think it's a good way to jump in here. The word history is Greek in origin. Its definition as a literary genre and the extent to which its use for biblical material may be anachronistic are questions raised by recent scholarship. History, for most modern Westerners, okay, keep that in your mind, most modern people, history is what happened in the past, and, you know, that's it. History is what happened in the past. Well, that's a little simplistic. History and history writing as a literary genre is an account, yes, an account of what happened in the past. That's true, but that's not all that we're dealing with here. The latter is judged, again, the way it gets written, you know, these genre considerations. The latter is judged by how accurately and objectively it recounts past events. There's some recognition that historians have their own biases, and that no one is completely objective, and that writing history involves interpretation. And all those things are true. If pressed, most moderns probably will admit that it may be impossible to know for certain exactly what happened in the past. Nevertheless, telling exactly what happened remains the goal and the essential definition of the genre, you know, history, as it is generally envisioned. That's the end of the quote. So for most modern people, if you ask them what history is, it's, oh, that's what happened in the past. And they don't really think too much beyond that. I'll add another assumption that many moderns, especially critics, bring to the table. They have been taught that crediting the causation of events, whether directly or providentially, to God, you know, having God as the cause of events cannot be considered history. That's just the way people are taught, you know, academically. And the reason is people will say, we can't really be sure objectively, like scientifically, if God exists. And if we can't be sure about that, then we can't be sure about his activity. How would we know that God's the cause of something if we don't even know that God is for real, that we can't objectively, and that's the key word, we can't objectively, scientifically prove, you know, God's existence. So if that's the case, we can't say anything about what he might or might not have done. Now, do you see the potential problems and inconsistencies with these ideas that history is a record of things that happened in the past? That's the goal of it. That's the only thing that we should, it's the only way we should evaluate a term like history. You know, this complete objective record of things that happened in the past, and then essentially removing God from the equation. Do you see the potential problems? Well, in case you don't, I'm going to go through a few of them. Historical reliability presumably requires then precise accuracy, exactitude, okay? We as moderns assume that to have real history, the account has to be absolutely, utterly, completely precise, or it can't be history. Now, I'm going to suggest that is flawed. That is way overstated. And I'm going to give you some concrete examples in a moment. It also assumes total objectivity is required for something to be truly historical. In other words, there's no intentional bias at all. There's no subconscious bias. We have to, unless we can have complete 100% infallible assurance that something is precisely accurate and totally objective, we cannot call it history. Now, that raises an obvious question, at least to me. Actually, a few obvious questions. How precise must you be in order to be considered accurate? Let's talk about sources. How many sources is enough? Because, you know, you'll have people that say, well, we can't really consider the Bible as a source for this event because we need another source to validate the first one. So if we only have a single source, we can't really see that as history. Well, there are some times when you get two or three sources and they're still not satisfied. You know, if the Bible is one of them, they still don't count it. And so my question is, well, how many do we need before we actually take the Bible seriously as a source? How many is enough? How about conversations? Do conversations count as historical evidence. Let's say, you know, in your own life, you have a conversation with somebody, you know, your dad 10 years ago. You know it occurred. Nobody else was there. Now, if you were writing your own biography, your autobiography, is that to be excluded as a source because it can't be correlated? Like, you just wipe that off the table like it never happened when you know that it did? Well, I mean, if you're going to be completely, that might be bias in there because it was you and your dad, you know. You know, we can't really consider that now because you know, are you really objective? And boy, we wish we had more sources, and then we could correlate that with other sources and determine precise accuracy. Can you see where I'm going here? How about memories? Memories can be accurate even if nobody else was in the room. They really can. I mean, they can be flawed, obviously. It can work both ways. But to rule them out because nobody else was there, is that reasonable? Really, is that reasonable? Since an event and the interpretation of the event are two different things, can the event be made known reliably? If we know about your biases, that's another question. Is reliability made impossible or unlikely if we know about an author's bias? Put another way, does partial information about an event mean that what is said about the event is untrue? How exhaustive and inclusive and objective must the report be to be considered precise and unbiased? Now, when I was at the Frequency Conference, I used a book as an example. And here's the title of the book: Invisible. Subtitle: The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. And I picked this book because I was speaking to an overwhelmingly African-American audience. And I used this book to grab their attention because the book is about a very obscure Black woman lawyer at the Luciano, the Lucky Luciano trial. She was behind the scenes, and her grandson wrote this book about, you know, his grandmother and the role she played. Now, here are the questions. Is his history, because it's about his grandmother and he's related to her, is his history less objective than other histories of the Luciano trial? It must be because they're related. Well, can you objectively demonstrate that it's biased? Less objective? Or are you assuming something that you really can't prove? And that might be disproved if we, you know, look at the transcripts of the court records and all that sort of stuff. So is this history really less objective? Were the lives of all the other people involved in this trial, were they all researched at the same level of detail as this woman? Oh, well, to be objective history, he should have written books on all the lawyers that were involved, because then we could rule out bias, and then we could cross-check information. We could see, you know, we could get this, you know, super precision that we need to call it history. Really? Really? You got to write books on everyone involved to call this one history? Really? How about, were there conversations from which the data are drawn? Okay, there certainly were. This is a courtroom. Were all the conversations recorded? Well, no. In his book, you know, he's interviewed people, you know, people who were there, people who were involved. Their conversations, what they're reporting to the author, they weren't recorded. They are memories. Are they all wrong because they're memories? Because they don't exist in written form somewhere? Again, it gets a little absurd. So here are some questions for us and for historical critics. Is your version of your own life objective? If you're telling your own life story, are you including all perspectives equally? You know, how would your first girlfriend in high school, you know, relate this? How would your mom, your sister, your aunt, you know, your cousin three times removed, you know? You know, do you have to exhaustively go to all of them and include all their thoughts to really tell the story of your own life and have it be historical? It might be incomplete without them, but that's the question. Is an incomplete accounting, is it still history? Is it an all or nothing proposition? And again, I'm suggesting it's not. It's not an all or nothing proposition. And in fact, there's no way to do all these things because conversations and recollections of events don't all get produced to written form and preserved so that somebody 100 years later can fact check them. It just isn't the way life happens. So could you actually even tell your own story by these standards? How precise are your data? Well, you're the only source for that data point, so we can't include it. And if we do include it, then it's not history. Are all the recollections you have cross-checked with other source documents? And how many are enough? And do you have recordings of all your Again, this is absurd. What about God? You know, does belief in divine activity in your own life, does that make something unhistorical? You know, divine causation shows up in many ancient Near Eastern accounts that are not in the Bible. You know, like Ramses' victory at Kadesh over the Hittite. You know, they attribute the activity of their gods to the outcome of events. So why do we consider those things historical, but we can't do that with the Bible? Why? Well, I think we kind of know. Because if we do that with the Bible, then we actually have to count it as a source. And if we count it as a source for our history and we can't invalidate it, then maybe we're accountable to it because, you know, that we look at the Bible as something different in terms of, you know, our accountability to God and so on and so forth. You know, we don't do that with Egyptian texts and Assyrian texts and Hittite texts. But then we use a false test, divine activity in the story, to rule out the Bible when we're just fine accepting it on the other side. That's inconsistent. I'm going to tell you my own, to illustrate this, I'm going to tell you my own story of how I got my job at Logos. Okay, we have a few minutes left here. And this, I think, illustrates well the question of history versus mythic history, including supernatural events and characters in the story. And how they both can be historical. You know, it's not a mutually exclusive idea. So here's how I got my job at Logos. And again, this is me. I'm not embellishing it. It's just the story. It just is what it is. So when I was in my last year at grad school at Wisconsin, I'm going to finish the program in like 2 months, which means I'm going to lose, I always had 2 or 3 jobs, but I'm going to lose all but one job, which means I'm going to lose my health benefits. And basically 2/3 of my income in 2 months. So I have been applying for jobs since I hit the dissertation phase, which was 4.5 years, almost 5 years prior. And I'm not getting any nibbles. Okay. We could go into details as to why that may have happened. I don't really know, but I'd only have guesses at that point. But there I am. I don't have a job. I don't know what I'm going to do. I got 4 kids, you know, and it's just not looking real good. So one of the things I was doing for four, almost 5 years, is looking at the SBL, Society of Biblical Literature, website where they post jobs. I know from 4 years of experience at that time, they only update the site the first week of every month. I've had 4 years of that. I know it's entirely predictable. So I'm in the middle of the month. I come home, you know, from teaching, you know, one day. I get home. I got a couple minutes to kill. My wife's not home yet. She's out with the kids doing something. And I'm just kind of bored. I'm a little bit depressed. You know, I'm just wondering, what in the world am I going to do? And I thought, well, let's go look at the job board. And I'm telling myself while I'm sitting at the keyboard typing, you're just wasting time. You know that it's going to be exactly what you saw 2 weeks ago. This is stupid. Do something else. You know, feed the dog. Just do something else. This is dumb. So I'm having this internal conversation while I'm going to the website, and the web page opens, and it's been updated for the first time in over 4 years, in the middle of a month. And I'm astonished. And the job that has just popped in there is the job I presently have. It was the Logos job. So I have everything ready. I've been doing this for years. I've got my resume. I fire this thing off in an email. You know, my wife, you know, comes home, and less than an hour later, after doing that, I get a phone call, And it's a friend of mine, you know, now, Bill, his name was. And we start talking about this job. And then he loops in Bob, our CEO, and he loops in our, that then Dale is retired now, but Bob's dad, Dale, was our VP of the company. He gets looped into the conversation. We sit there for an hour and talk. And at the end of it, Bob says, well, we, you know, we want to have you out here. You know, come out and visit the office and we'll do a formal interview. You meet the people that you would be working with. And you know, we'll just take a couple days and see what happens. And so I looked at my wife and told her what was going on. And I said, you know, why not? You know, it's like a little vacation. You know, we get a couple days on the West Coast, you know, Northwest. We've never been there. Let's do it. So, okay, why not? You know, we don't have any reason to say no. So we went out and visited, you know, we went out to dinner. Bob likes to interview people at dinner. We met everybody that I'd be working with. You know, we went through the whole thing. And so at the end of this, I'm expecting, you know, to hear, well, you know, it was good to have you out. You know, we need a week or so to think about what you know, happened here and we'll get back to you. So I walk into Bob's office and he looks at me and he says, well, we've decided to offer you the job. Here's what it pays, blah, he's giving me all these details. Now, I know because I have cobbled an income together for years. I know exactly to the penny what we need to survive. And this is like more than that, and I can't believe it. So I'm like stunned that I actually have a job offer after 4.5 years of nothing. So, you know, I didn't really know what to say. And I said, well, can we have 24 hours to think about it? You know, it's a big move. And he's, oh, sure, you know, whatever, you know. And so I wind up obviously taking this job. Now, I found out years later from Dale that I was the first person to respond to that job posting. It had lived online for less than an hour. So it literally didn't exist when I was driving home from school. It literally popped out of the ether. And I saw it. Again, having the conversation with myself that this is stupid, don't look, and applied for it. He said, you were the only person we interviewed. That was it. We had the interview. That's it. You're the only person we interviewed, the only person we invited out. We're done. Now, I look at that, you know, let's be honest. I look at that and I see God's hand in it in, you know, half a dozen places. The job literally didn't exist until I got home. And I'm the only one that applied for it, you know, that the interview they brought in, they talked to, that was it. And we're just 2 weeks later, it's just a done deal. That's it. We don't need to have any other conversations. Now, if I attribute divine activity to that, what I'm doing is I'm taking a series of events and I'm mythicizing them. I'm assigning a divine role to things that really happened. Folks, those things happened. It's still history. What I'm suggesting is when we look at a book like the Bible and you have writers that theologize things, they do mythic history. That doesn't mean that the events they are using, that they are attributing divine influence and providence and even direct activity, it doesn't mean that those things are fabrications. Every one of you listening to this can do that kind of thing with your own life. Now, I may get to heaven and God might tell me, you know, in your reconstruction of what happened that day, you know, I really wasn't in, I was definitely in this thing, but that other thing over there, that was something else. You know, I wasn't panicked, you know, I'm being a little silly now. I mean, in other words, I might get corrected on how I parsed that, but it still happened. It's okay. You know, when we have the Bible, you know, that's what we have biblical writers doing. These things happened. The way they tell the story, okay, they may not be connecting dots quite, you know, the way God would connect them. Okay, but they're attributing divine activity to things that happen boots on the ground, and they're telling us the story. I think the Bible is a little more reliable, again, just because I think God has a more direct providential interest in how Scripture is produced than my retelling of how I got my job. But the idea is the same. Attributing divine activity to to a series of events, yeah, that's mythic in academies, in the academic, you know, dialect. That's mythic history. But it doesn't mean it's not historical. And we're going to run into that kind of thing in Exodus all over the place. So maybe what we should do is, instead of judging history by modern expectations, you know, this exact precision needed, total objectivity, you know, valid, you can't have one source stand on its own. Again, even those criteria would undermine our ability to even tell our own story, things that we know occurred. So maybe instead of having a set of standards that really don't quite work that well in real life, you know, that don't really satisfy our modern way of thinking, maybe we should be thinking about how ancient people looked at what they were doing. You know, when ancient historians wrote, they used speeches of people. They used conversation. They used dialogue. And since none of those things were recorded, yeah, they had to make up conversation. Nobody's following, you know, Achilles around or you know, Alexander around with a tape recorder. Historians will capture the gist, the essence of what was said in a dialogue that they invent. But it's faithful to what really happened and what was said. It's just not an exact reproduction. But we still view that as history, and they viewed it as history. I mean, we view it as history when we can put it in the context of our own lives, things that we know happen. If you're going to be this uber critic that's going to discount all this stuff, well, good. I want to see you write your own autobiography, and then I'll take your tests and apply it to what you just wrote about your own life, and we'll see if you really exist. It's inconsistent, is my point. So they used speeches. They used narrative. They did meta-narrative things. They were trying to capture an event appropriately, but they used literary creativity and even artificiality in the way they arrange things. But it still is faithful and is appropriate to what happened. They're still conveying true things. Just because it's non-modern, it's not the way moderns would do it, doesn't mean it's not true, doesn't mean it's not historical. So I think that's what we need to do. You know, we need to recognize that, you know, this is the way ancient historians do it. They incorporated things that moderns would be hesitant to include. They wrote for a different reason. They weren't just, you know, writing to recall the events of the past like they were bookkeepers. Okay, they're not just, you know, we have to be exact precision. Somebody's going to, you know, look, check on our work and, you know, like accountants or something. They were writing to convey things that happened, and they would get into the interpretation, the significance of why these things were happening. And they would parse things through divine activity because they accepted that in their worldview. They examine present conditions and circumstances, and they try to teach things through them, you know, some moral objective or theological objective. It doesn't mean that the thing they're using to teach that lesson wasn't real. They're just doing something a little bit differently than we would do it today. So again, this is the kind of thing that we're going to run into in the book of Exodus. It's important, I think, to try to be consistent in the methods that we, you know, use to evaluate whatever we're reading in the book of Exodus or something else, you know, some other ancient piece of material, and also try to keep things in their own context. You know, that's what's important here. So hopefully, again, this helps prepare us for the rest of the book, because we're going to get into this stuff a lot. A lot of things you know about, a lot of things will be new to you. But again, this is where we're headed.
All right, Mike, I'm excited. As always, I'm going to have to prepare by watching the Ten Commandments movie.
You do that.
I've watched that movie at least once for every year as a child growing up, because I didn't have cable. I only had three channels. I don't remember which network played it, but every year, you know, they'd play it and I'd watch it, and I love it. So I told my family, since we're covering it, we're going to have to watch the Ten Commandments. And my wife was like, didn't you just make us watch that last year?
Right. And the year before.
Yeah. The answer is yes. And guess what? We're going to watch it again. But So did you like that movie, the 1956 version?
I do like it. It's Hollywood, you know, but
yeah, sure.
It's a good watch, you know. Yeah. It kind of holds up.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. All right. Well, we're all looking forward to chapter one next week, Mike. And again, appreciate everybody that voted and propelled the Book of Exodus at the last 11th hour to win. And with that, I just want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.